Okay, Mr. Monk?
May it please the court, Brandon Monk for appellant Dr. Jonathan Castile. I would like to start out by discussing the claims that were asserted in the child court in the first admitted petition. So there was some confusion, I think, associated with that at the child court level. I believe that the magistrate judge Stetson analyzed this mostly as a claim under 1985. The first thing I'd point out about that seemed a little off base was that the 1985 claim requires allegations of some class-based animus, and those allegations were not part of that First Amendment complaint. The intention was to assert Texas Whistleblower Act claims as the district only. Those claims can only be asserted against the district and not the individuals.
Okay, you're mentioning the First Amendment complaint. So is that the complaint that was disallowed, or?
No, there was a Second Amendment complaint that was disallowed, and so I've gone back to the First Amendment.
That's fine. I just wanted to clarify.
To counter my discussion on that, I'll say the Second Amendment complaint does develop the facts a little bit better, although the timeline and the facts are laid out in the First Amendment complaint such that the court, I think, could discern that this was a First and a 14th Amendment case. There are some things in the First Amendment complaint that would point the court in that direction as well, which is specific allegations of deliberate indifference, which is, you know, a specific standard as the 1983 claims. And of course, the First and 14th Amendment was raised in that First Amendment complaint specifically. Those things on top of the detailed factual allegations and timelines, which I'll get into, that show the temporal proximity based on the reports of this special need students being abused, and then the false allegations against Dr. Castile that would come closely thereafter, those reports that he was making. First, clarity on the claims, I think, is important. Second, I think it's important to talk about the qualified immunity issue, because we see this very differently than the trial court did. As a threshold matter, we do not see that they even get to the qualified immunity defense. And the case that the court should look to there, of course, is the Cherry Knoll case. But the concept is that if there is not anything that is discretionary here that is involved, and here we're talking about things that are non-discretionary as defined by state law, and things that are non-discretionary as defined by district policy, which is you cannot retaliate against a person in Dr. Castile's position who has made the kind of report that he's made. The kind of reporting that he did is, it's universal reporting that any citizen could do, but this gets interesting because he's doing it in the context of he is a current employee. And so that's where we get into these interesting First Amendment issues in this particular case. But the tie-in in terms of where does qualified immunity become invoked? I think that they've got to say, well, there was some discretion that the district had that they could retaliate against Dr. Castile for these reports that he's made, and that's completely absent. So for that reason, we never get into this qualified immunity analysis where, of course, the court, if it gets into that, could take those in any order that it wanted to, and the magistrate judge moved into this analysis that maybe it was not a clearly established right, getting very specific about how they got to that decision. But a little bit about the timeline, I think I'd point the court to some facts in the timeline. First, we have this August 17th, 2021. That's the first abuse allegation that appears. And this one is educator Oliver is, as a form of discipline, withholding food from a JM, a special needs minor within the district. Then we have September 22nd, 2021. This is abuse incident number two. Bienvenue is caught on camera interrogating a student named FR, and there's a table flipping incident that's caught on the video camera, which becomes subject to review where Dr. Castile and Principal Oliva are reviewing that video together and a later incident that happens. That incident happens on October 6, 2021, where Oliva calls Castile in to review a partial video from September 29, 2021, Well, they've started to make some allegation that Dr. Castile was on a video and did not interfere with a fight or intervene to try to stop a fight that had been captured on video September 29th, 2021. So that becomes the first false allegation. And in the record, the allegations in the complaint show that Dr. Castile was only shown a part of the video. He insisted that the rest of the video would show that he did intervene in the fight and did stop the altercation, but that there were other educators that did not. And so on the facts as alleged in the first amended complaint, this is the first false allegation they attempt to establish, coming in real close proximity to these reports of abuse that he's involved with on the campus.
At some point, and I don't want to interrupt your presentation, I just wanted you to tell me very specifically who he reported child abuse to and when.
So specifically, he made reports to Principal Oliva. Those reports come from the September 22nd, 2021 incident. They come about as a result of the fact that parents are in dialogue with him, know of the existence of a video, and they continue to follow up and sort of ask the status of this video. He is a liaison, and so part of his role is to continue to maybe follow up and see if the parents could get access to the video. So he's involved with reporting at that time associated with the abuse.
Any other times that he reported child abuse to anybody?
So on December the 13th and 14th of 2021, he gives an interview to the CPS, which is very significant in the case.
And how did that come about? Did he call them, text them? Did he contact CPS?
He had been persistent with the district about following up with these issues on behalf of the parents, but eventually the investigator knows that he's a witness, and they have him come in to give a statement. And he gives that statement with Principal Oliva present. During some of that statement, there's even some disagreement about some of the basic facts. Principal Oliva makes some statements that Castile disagrees with during the course of that interview. And so, of course, that's cooperation and additional reporting related to this incident. On October 19th, 2021, sort of going back a step, Dr. Castile files a grievance with the district.
Okay, just to be clear, any other times that he reported some way to CPS?
Well, the CPS interview, he does go on and follow up with the superintendent. He cooperates at every stage with the CPS interview, but in terms of his other follow-ups, I don't know that the record shows any additional follow-ups there. But the October 2021 grievance is not really related so much to his employment consideration as much as it is his pursuit of that there should be discipline against Oliver and Bienvenue for this abuse. So I think that reporting is significant, even though it is within the district. It is.
That was my next question. What does the Texas law require a person? If I see child abuse, who am I required by law to report to?
So there are different requirements in terms of a citizen universal obligation, and then in his capacity as an educator, there's a certain obligation as well, so I'll divide those up that way. But any person that sees abuse, of course, has an obligation to report that.
To whom?
Well, the standard about who to report in a general universal sense is not...
What does the statute say?
It's not... The Family Code statute specifically talks about in an educator context, if he sees the abuse, he's to report within 48 hours to the district and to CPS. So there's a requirement of report to CPS. But some of his knowledge about this doesn't necessarily come up within that 48-hour reporting period so that he would have been the initial report of some of these things. Of course, there are follow-ups, and he cooperates, and they know that he cooperates. It gets to the point where Dr. Portery, the superintendent, is said to have made a statement along the lines that they're after him, that they want to get rid of him. And that makes it back to him through Principal Oliva, in short proximity to all this cooperation, where he also writes a letter to Assistant Superintendent Dr. Getwood, and he urges that there should be a full investigation and review of this video. He insists on numerous occasions that the video should be reviewed and that that would be appropriate so that the parents could learn what happened in these instances. So he's behind it, you know, through December, which in January, I think 6th of 2022, this is when we get the additional false allegation related to these sprayers. The scenario is there's a warehouse, this is during COVID, there are donations that are being made. He's allowed to take items away and use them with the campus and sort of check them out in some loose fashion. He takes, sometimes he checks them in and receives them, but then he takes these two foggers and he goes and he uses them in an auditorium. He marks them specifically that it's not the property of that high school, and then he boxes them back up, and eventually the foggers make it back and return to the warehouse. But then sort of an after-the-fact claim is that he was supposed to have checked them out in some specific policy way that was never defined to him. So with no notice of what the policy was, there's a due process concern that he doesn't even know that he's violated anything if he doesn't know that there's a rule along those lines. So that becomes very important.
What was he told? By told, I mean by orally or in writing, about the reason for the termination?
He's eventually told that it's because he did not provide a statement that was being requested of him by HR Weiber. And he does provide that statement. He was working on it with his lawyer. He provides it on February the 15th. But the reason they give on February 14th is they began to claim that they had officially asked for this statement. They had not officially asked for this statement. There had been some conversation in passing with Weibel where it was suggested that, you know, I may need you to write a statement. And if I need you to write a statement, I will let you know about it. Dr. Castile then goes to a funeral. He is out for some time. They call him while he's at the funeral, and they tell him, we need you to work on the statement. So he receives the message that while he's at the funeral, he needs to work on the statement. He immediately coordinates with his lawyer and gets it in short proximity. But that's the third false allegation.
The requested statement, or whether it was a question or not, what did the statement require of him or ask of him?
The statement would have been related to the issue with the father. They wanted to know his side of the story related to what had occurred with this fogger false allegation about what he used it for. Was he trying to steal it? He certainly was not. It would be his opportunity to describe and explain that, which he did turn in, which is, you know, he didn't get notice immediately that they wanted it.
I just want to be sure what you're saying. The statement ultimately was or was not provided?
It was provided on February the 15th, and he received the notice on February the 14th of what they were going to do. So of the discipline related to the statement.
All right, so the discipline was imposed before he provided the statement?
One day before. He had been actively working on it, but they sort of did not give him a definitive timeline when they needed it. I didn't tell him initially that they needed it.
What was the date where they called him at the funeral and he said, I'll get it to you in a few days? What date was
that? I believe that was around the 7th or so.
And then when was the ice storm?
I think the ice storm, it was at the same time because the ice storm was occurring around the same time as the funeral. So we had the 7th through the 10th where we're dealing with the ice storm and the funeral in that time window. So the second component of the qualified immunity analysis, if the court was to find that it was invoked in some way through this discretionary issue, which we've discussed, the Cherry Knoll issue, would be for the court to look at whether the speech was as a matter of public concern. Clearly, when you're talking about speaking related to abuse of special needs children, and you have family code provisions which establish reporting requirements and provide a cause of action, and you have district policy, which ties in with those requirements, that component also identifies.
Do we look at all at state law in determining whether he was acting as a member of the public versus an educator? In other words, at least my memory of Texas law is the whistleblower statutes, for example, in Texas are very specific about to whom you must report. And reporting to somebody other than that does not suffice to give you whistleblower status. Should we look at that in determining whether he was a member of the public versus an educator?
I think you can look at it for that reason. I think you can also look at it to determine as to whether the district had discretion in this area. State law would restrain them. So it would be a source of how that discretion is eliminated and becomes a mandate for how they would need to act in this circumstance, which is to not retaliate.
All right, Mr. Monk, you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Allen?
May it please the court, I'm Rudius Allen, here on behalf of the appellees. So to quickly answer your question, Judge Richman, it is required under the Texas Whistleblower Act for it to be reported to law enforcement authority. And while we're on this topic of...
I'm sorry, law enforcement or whom?
To law enforcement authority.
Not CPS? Would that include CPS?
I believe it would. And that's the Texas Government Code 554.002. But
did he contact either of those categories?
We're looking at his complaint. This was a motion to dismiss, and whether or not he made allegations that are not conclusory for the court to reasonably infer yes or no. And the allegations, there's really two main paragraphs. This speaks about on page 290 of the record that he spoke with a CPS investigator, and he was interviewed by a CPS investigator. So we look at Garcetti, and I know this case, Carey versus Aldean, was decided at this panel of the circuit, but it was within a Texas district court. Very similar facts in which a teacher was spoken to by a CPS agent regarding potential abuse at home that carried over into school. And in that case, the court said, similar to an employee, and Garcetti, in which their roles day to day are to supervise students, classroom management, and if there's a concern of abuse, then they need to report that to their supervisor, to the principal, to the superintendent.
So this was you are saying that this was part of his official job responsibilities, not speaking primarily as a private citizen.
And it would be different if he made direct reports to CPS, but here he just responded to the CPS investigation, to questions, and corresponded with them. So it's one thing to go out of your way as a public citizen and say, I'm concerned, something's going on here, I need to make a report to CPS. But this was done, and he's assistant principal for special education. So he's aware what goes on day to day, and there could be multiple reports. And I think it's a concern if we get to a point where an employee can make a report, internal report in this instance, and state that I can never face any type of adverse personal action because I made a report. And obviously we have Texas Whistleblower Act, and I believe that's where this case really heads to, but it should have been filed in state court. And outside of that, we don't really get into a constitutional violation. We have this for claims and acts for that purpose. And to provide some context with regards to what they believe was in retaliation for protected speech, Dr. Castile was never at any point authorized to take those sprayers from the warehouse. And I know it's not in the record, but there's a video him waiting for the warehouse manager to leave. And then he quickly grabbed the sprayers and left. Once this was made aware to the district, he was placed on suspension with pay. There was an investigation. On the conclusion of the investigation, Dr. Portery made recommendations to the board for proposed termination. Once the board determined to make that proposed termination, he was notified, Dr. Castile.
I thought he alleged I thought he alleged he actually interacted with someone when he took, when he checked out the foggers.
The next day, he did interact with Mr. Rudeau, Edgar Rudeau, who was over operations, director over operations.
And what was that interaction?
So Mr. Rudeau was just trying to figure out what happened, where are these sprayers, and he essentially stated that you need to return them immediately because it was the warehouse manager who, I guess, provided some information to Mr. Rudeau that Castile left with some sprayers and he didn't check them out.
Well, he says in his complaint, I thought, that he cleaned up the gym or the area and left the sprayers on the school property and took them back the next morning. Is that accurate as to what he pled?
There's no evidence that that happened. He did bring back the sprayers the following day, but the concern was at the time he was not authorized to take the sprayers.
No, Judge Richmond is asking you what did he plead about that? Well, not what you think the evidence might ultimately show.
That's what he pleaded, that Mr. Rudeau said, hey, you're fine next time, just make sure that you sign out. But I guess he was here, it wasn't done until after the investigation that it was,
Well, this is a 12B6.
It is. So we're looking at the complaint, and that's what the allegation is. And there are very few non-conclusory allegations. And we're speaking about qualified immunity here today. He states that we didn't meet our initial burden. So I think it's worthwhile to consider the roles of each individual appellee. We have Dr. Cordery, who was and is the superintendent of Port Arthur in the school district. We have Dr. Melissa Leva, who was the principal and supervisor of Dr. Castile. Then we have two teachers, Mr. Oliver and Ms. Yavin, who were subordinates to Dr. Castile. And with regards to any personnel actions, with the proposed termination, Dr. Porter didn't make a recommendation. Dr. Oliva did not have any role in that recommendation. She did suspend him with pay in the semester, fall semester, but she did not suspend him with pay in the spring semester. That was Dr. Porter. Those are all personal actions that require judgment and deliberation. I think those are quintessential job functions of their roles as principals and supervisors, and as a superintendent. So I think we carry our discretionary authority burden there. We move on to the burden of the plaintiff. But with regards to the two teachers, so we have several cases in the circuit, Bevel versus Fletcher, Sims versus the City of Madisonville, Atkins versus Hawkins, Kenny versus Weaver, and those are all dealing with supervisors. In Sims, it states that he was a coworker, but he was a supervisor, he was a chief. And in the other cases, these are outside influencers stating that it was improper influence. But with regards to these teachers, I guess the question posed to this panel is, what is required of a defendant to carry their initial burden when the challenged conduct has no relation to the actual adverse action? Because again, we're in an employment law context. The teachers had no role, they weren't part of an investigation for the termination, they weren't made witnesses, there was no statements by them. But it's just the conclusory allegation that they somehow conspired with the principal and superintendent to terminate him. And if we look in the context of, let's say, a Jane Doe, John Doe case, or Perry Green's ADA claim against the school district, excessive corporal punishment, you know, teachers still have qualified immunity and state that their discretionary authority was classroom management and student supervision. So if they have discretionary authority in those cases regarding child abuse and neglect, I believe they would have discretionary authority here. Again, but it's concerned that if someone's brought into a suit which they are public officials regarding to the Texas Education Code by state law, so long as they're acting within their discretionary authority, of course, that they have to bear the burdens of the cost of litigation, go through, you know, discovery and to trial. where they had no involvement in the actual alleged constitutional deprivation. So, you know, I believe this, the discretionary authority prong is carried there, especially for Dr. Porter and Dr. Oliva with regards to personnel matters. And with the teachers, too, they really had no involvement. But I guess their roles in day-to-day classroom management and student supervision should still allow them to carry their initial burden. And very briefly, counsel didn't really go over the procedural due process and substantive due process claims. I think that is pretty straightforward in the brief. Essentially, the circuit in Rodriguez versus Isleta Independent School District stated that the proceedings in the Chapter 21 Education Code satisfies the due process requirements. Get notified of the proposed termination, get an opportunity to refute those allegations by asking for a trial-like hearing, the independent hearing examiner. The independent hearing examiner is called to decide whether or not there is good cause for termination. That was done here. And it brings it back to the board, which the employee has another opportunity for a hearing to refute those allegations. That happened here. The board did find and adopt those findings of facts and conclusions of law. And then he has another opportunity. He can appeal it to the Texas Education Commissioner. That was done here. And the Education Commissioner also found that there was good cause. So it wasn't a one and done thing. It was very by the book as required by the Texas Education Code. And while he does have a property interest in his contract, there's no expectation beyond the term of that contract. So his contract was to 2022-2023 school year. And for a mid-contract termination, you have to have good cause finding, and that's what was done here. And he speaks about the Texas Family Code, section 261.110, provides him with some federal property right interests. That's just false. That's an anti-retaliation statute, similar to the Texas Whistleblower Act, in which they can bring a cause of action under state law and state court. So, again, I think that's clear in the briefings, but I do want to go a little bit more into the First Amendment retaliation, because we did see in Sims versus the City of Madisonville that a non-decision maker can be held liable as long as there's a recommendation, and I believe a little bit further in Bevel versus Fletcher that there was improper influence imputed on the decision maker.
Well, you heard the discussion about the timeline involving his filing of a response and the funeral and the delay and all of that. Would you comment on what is your client's position as to that timeline and as it related to the reason for termination?
Yeah, while we requested the statement from Dr. Castillo, that really had no, it wasn't a reason for termination. And again, we had a full-blown hearing in a hearing examiner regarding whether or not there was good cause.
So what was the, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but so what was the reason for termination if it was not?
The primary reason was for taking property that was unauthorized from the warehouse in violation of multiple district policies.
All right, so it was the it was the taking of the property, not the failure to provide a statement.
No, it was not for the failure to provide a statement. He did provide a statement, and that was taken into consideration as part of that local record of the hearing examiner as well as the board and commissioner.
The ultimate decision then by the commissioner was that the evidence showed that he had taken the property improperly. Is that right? Or I'm not putting words in your mouth. I just want to understand.
Essentially, that is correct. And There are also other district policies regarding code of ethics that found that we violated, but primarily.
What code of ethics? What code of ethics?
The educator code of ethics.
What did he violate, what did he do to violate it?
So I don't have it right in front of me, but there's several things similar to an attorney code of ethics that you cannot act, you know, outside of the expected, reasonable expectations of your job.
What did it relate to?
So, I mean, he wasn't even, I wasn't part of his job to go and spray the gym. We had janitors and custodians to do that, so he went out of his way to do that. And it wasn't just the sprayers. There were other supplies that were valued up to about $2,000 that were also taken, and he didn't have authorization to do so. But sprayers were obviously the most expensive items, which is why they were focused on those. So going back to the recommendation and proper influence requirement to show individual causation, that immediately takes out Dr. Oliva, Ms. Biavenu, and Mr. Oliver, because they made no recommendation to the board for the termination. Now, with regards to Dr. Cordery, while he made the recommendation, there still has to be shown some type of retaliatory animus. And I'll bring the court's attention to page 298 of the record. It still only states that Dr. Cordery proposed termination of Castillo's contract without proper notice. That's the extent of the allegation with regards to Dr. Cordery. Again, we're looking at individual causation. And so we take each allegation against each individual defendant and not just group them all together. So looking at the complaint, that falls incredibly short of what is needed to show constitutional violation. I think we did discuss a little bit about whether or not that's the cooperation being interviewed by CPS agent is protected speech. He didn't provide any case law that would make it beyond debate that acting within his job duties, their expectations to respond to CPS agents regarding potential child abuse would be considered speech by a public citizen and be determined as protected speech. And he also cites to Lane versus Springs, but that's the case distinguishable because that was sworn testimony outside of the job duties. Here, this is just an everyday scenario, which obviously you have law enforcement, either be local or state, having questions with regard to students in the care of the district that will need to speak on the matter and speak truthfully on the matter. Moving to the civil conspiracy, obviously the district court did not get to a discussion with regards to the individual appellees because there was no finding of constitutional violation. Assuming arguendo that their qualified immunity is defeated, we still have this intra-corporate conspiracy doctrine, in which all these employees were employed by the Arthur Independent School District. It's one single entity. But one single entity cannot conspire by itself. And most importantly, you still have to show an agreement. You have to allege an agreement, but not just the mere allegation of the agreement, but about showing some context that they met, as we saw in other cases. I believe that was Pebble versus Fletcher, in which there were several meetings between the judges, the DA, and the mayor of wanting to get rid of the plaintiff. Here, there's no allegations that they ever even met. It's just a conclusory allegation, and the legal conclusion that they conspired together to deprive Castillo of his constitutional rights. That's the extent of the allegation with regards to an agreement being made. And that alone should alleviate the individual defendants or Port Arthur and school district being found liable or being saying that there was a constitutional violation for civil conspiracy purposes. And again, whether it's analyzed under 1985 or 1983, similar elements to both, just 1985 requires some class-based discriminatory animus. 1983 is a little bit, similar, just showing that there was an agreement and a constitutional deprivation occurred. The intercorporate conspiracy doctrine still applies. And lastly, counsel spoke about deliberate indifference, trying to get to a point where there is Monell liability. There was only one allegation of that, and that wasn't a legal conclusion in the request for relief that the district acted deliberately indifferent. That's conclusion. That's a conclusory allegation. Should not be considered because we saw that in Iqbal Twombly. The rest of my time, I just wanted to ask this panel to affirm the district court's decision.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Monk for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So speak to the whole due process issue and also to the question of whether there was additional property that was allegedly taken from the warehouse or whatever, and then whether all of that was considered up the line all the way through to the commissioner.
Yes. So the commissioner really would exceed, or hearing examiner really would exceed their authority in delving off into these constitutional issues. Their jurisdiction is really limited to whether there was a violation of some school laws of the state. So our position is that really the hearing examiner did not delve off into and could not have without, had no jurisdiction to get into the due process issue or the First Amendment issue. So for the due process issue, the way I'll talk about this is with respect to the family code and district policy is providing some rights there.
Well, what did the hearing examiner address the question of the taking of the property?
The hearing examiner attempted to address the issue, but really could not delve into the circumstances around surrounding First Amendment retaliation or due process such that he would even have notice that this was a violation.
All right, let me ask a question maybe for the third time. Did the hearing examiner address at all the question of whether the property was taken or whether that was, if so, whether that was enough of a cause for termination?
There were facts and testimony related to that issue, and so it was addressed at the hearing by testimony. For example, to go back to a question from Judge Richmond, there was an individual, Ms. Williams, Demetria Williams, who had interacted with Dr. Castile around the time of the checkout of these items, and so she did offer testimony at the hearing that was presented in terms of the facts at the hearing. The discussion of the debate would be about, well, did she tell him that he needed to do this in a different way? Or did anybody identify to him that he was, needed to sign out specifically to check these items out? He did use these items. They were there and generally available for use on the campus during this COVID emergency time. They were donations. And so their statement that he used the items or used thousands of dollars of items, that's not an appropriate conduct.
What did the hearing examiner find?
The hearing examiner found factually that the district had met its burden for non-renewal and the recommendation for non-renewal.
On what factual basis?
On the factual basis of the allegation of this fogger issue and the delay of notice of providing the statement. I mean, those things were all addressed at the hearing factually, the testimony. I think it's just the legal conclusions that we really question, and there was an appeal from that decision that was part of this case as it began. I think now, of course, jurisdiction really would be associated with the First and 14th Amendment claims and the First Amendment complaint. Those 1983 claims become the anchor claims for any other jurisdiction that the court would exercise, such as related to the Texas Whistleblower Act claim. But the family code does provide a basis for Dr. Castile to say that his cooperation with CPS is required.
Can you give me the cite to that?
That is Texas Family Code 206.011, I believe, is what we're dealing with.
206. What?
0.011, I believe. is what we're dealing with there. It is cited in the briefing as well, and there's snippets of it, of this particular provisions that make it into the district policy, local district policy, DG, as well. And so that all gets incorporated and provides additional support for Dr. Castile, that his participation was required. And so then we sort of tie in with some cases that we cite in the briefs, which are one, Johnson versus City of Shelby. The court could look to the factual allegations in the complaint in addition to these statements about deliberate indifference. I think counsel discounts those factual allegations altogether, and there's a detailed factual basis for the claims. But the other case I'll point to is Kentucky versus Department of Corrections, which discusses that a state creates a liberty interest by restricting official discretion. And so with these restrictions of discretion as to the district that come from the family code and from the local district policy, there's tie-in support for the due process claim in that way as well for Dr. Castile.
Thank you, Mr. Monk. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Thank you.